Well, good morning. Like I said, we have been looking at the life of David. If you've been with us here online, looking at the life of David and a man after God's own heart, he is the hero of our story that we have been looking at for the last several weeks. And I would have to say, I feel like this is a story that a little bit I thought I knew better than I actually knew. And so as we're going into this today, I do want to give a heads up. This is the story that takes a dark turn, like I said, for our hero. And especially if you're at home and you have kids, I'm not like getting explicit on things, but if you know the story of David and Bathsheba, there is some adult content to it in a way. And like I said, there's some, you know, violence and murder, and it's not pleasant. So just some discretion as a little warning. Also, Pastor Dean didn't like make me take this one. Like, oh, this is a hard one. You get it. There's some question about that. It was like, wow, he really gave you a hard one. It's like, no, I volunteered. Which earlier in this week, as I was prepping it, I'm like, man, this was unwise. To prep, maybe it was a little harder than I realized or was thinking. But like I said, I'm actually glad I did, because I thought this was a story I knew, but getting ready, God took me through it in a different way than I have looked at it before, a different perspective on it. And as awful as it is, there is also some really beautiful images of God's forgiveness and his redemption. And it may not be quite what you're thinking, in the way that you're thinking as I say that. So, like I said, past several weeks looking at David. Now, this is a man. He was not made king because of his parents, you know, the line that he came from. It wasn't because of his parents, or it wasn't what he looked like. He wasn't, they call him ruddy, which means young and, you know, red-faced, kind of. Not kingly as such. And then last week, well, he becomes king not because of how he looks or his line, but because of, really, it's more how he acts. He's a man after God's own heart. He does things passionately, and loving God is one of those things that he does, and he does it with fervor. Everything he does, you know, foreskins, here you go. He does everything over the top, including when he sins, to be honest, and when he falls. And when he falls, like today, he falls hard. So last week, you know, he danced, and he danced with so much emotion. Well, his emotions were showing is how much he danced, right? He danced with that. It made people uncomfortable because he was so in love with God and the ark returning. And then this week, it's like the opposite. He goes from this kind of a high to this kind of a low as he just forgets who he is and what he stands for, I think. If you have a Bible, I'm going to encourage you to open it to 2 Samuel 11. If you don't have a Bible and you'd like to follow along, we'll have it on the screen, but we also can put one in your hands. Our ushers can hand one out. Just put a hand up and they'll get you one of those. So 2 Samuel 11. Before we read that, though, in 10, just the right before here, if you... I want you to be familiar with what's going on. David had just experienced kind of a great win in the world of war and of fighting. When David was told of this, he gathered all of Israel, crossed the Jordan, and went to Helam. The Arameans formed their battle lines to meet David and fought against him. But they fled before Israel, and David killed 700 of their charioteers and 40,000 of their foot soldiers. He also struck down Shobak, the commander of their army, and he died there. When all the kings who were vassals of Hadadezer saw that they had been routed by Israel, they made peace with the Israelites and became subject to them. So the Arameans were afraid to help the Ammonites anymore. So that's a hooray, right? Our king, our David, he leads, Israel wins. And that's a key point. When David leads, Israel wins because God has anointed him and said, "You're my guy. When you lead, Israel wins." That's important. Hang on to that. As we start 11, then it happened. That sounds so subtle, but it opens up a big old floodgate into the rest of this story. So then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle. Since we're not subject to this in this day and age, but at that time, through the winter months, they didn't fight. Too wet. There wasn't the food they needed, so they stopped fighting for a time. And then when spring is there, you can get around easier. There's food in the fields, for your troops as you invade another land. And so they would start fighting in the spring. It's the time when all kings go out to battle, when the kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they brought destruction to the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed in Jerusalem. So an astute reader will know, wait a second, that's not right. David is supposed to be leading the troops, not sending them off to fight. And it's a little reminiscent, in my mind, of what Saul does with David and Goliath, right? Saul doesn't go out and fight Goliath. Well, he's God's chosen. He's the king. He should have gone out and fought in the name of the Lord, but he doesn't do it. Instead, David does. And I feel like there's a little bit of a similarity there when David himself is not out leading the troops. And you have to ask, well, why not? Why wasn't he there? And in my mind, it's like, was he just didn't want to go? Maybe the idea of being king was starting to settle in a little bit more, and this bed, my king size bed's really nice. Get it? Yeah, it's king size bed. Okay, but he's like thinking, my king size bed is really nice right here, right? I don't want to go sleep in a tent. Sorry, off subject. I had a friend who said this once about camping. He says, "I don't understand why people pay to downgrade their lifestyle." I like that. I like camping, but I just thought that was hilarious. So he didn't want to downgrade his lifestyle. Maybe that's why David didn't go. We don't really know, but the point, he wasn't where he was supposed to be. He wasn't leading the people like he was supposed to be leading. And I think that is the first hint that something's wrong, that bad things are going to be coming, because David is not doing what he should be doing. Now, verse 2, it says, "Now at evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house." Why? Maybe it was normal. Like the time of day it was, maybe it wasn't like that odd, but I don't know about you, but if I am up and walking around, there's a reason, like I'm not sleeping. It seems, it's evening. I'm not settled down. I'm not, relaxing, getting ready for bed even, or, whatever. If I'm up and walking around, I think that indicates something's going on. And maybe it's, like I said, maybe it's just his normal routine. Maybe he ate some bad lamb and just wanted to, get up and walk around because his stomach was upset. Maybe he was unsettled, though, because remember, he's not where he's supposed to be. And I wonder if that's not why he was up and walking around, because things weren't right. So it says, "And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance." Now, I'm not sure about you, but this is one of the first things that I thought differently. I always thought she was on the roof. I realize I probably thought that because of Leonard Cohen song, but I always thought she was on the roof, on a roof also. And so when I started looking at this, and I was looking at, thinking it was going to be some sort of Jewish custom, or, the way they did things or whatever, and it's like, nope, probably not. It was more like David was up there looking, and was looking down again on his people. And I went, that king setting in, like the king, I'm this king of power here up on my tall building, looking down on my subjects. Maybe starting to, think a little bit highly of himself. and he looks in on Bathsheba, and then this is another thing. I kind of thought it was maybe, you know, well, she's bathing, and we're thinking that's kind of a seductive kind of a thing, like, oh, you know, naked. He's looking down. He saw something. She's beautiful. But one of the things commentators, like some of them say, and there's an indication in just a minute, is that she was being a woman that was taking part in the monthly purification bathing. And so it was more like a ritual cleaning that she was doing. She may not even have been naked. She might have been washing, you know, because like they wash their hands and they do all kinds of washing ceremonies that they would call bathing. And so it's totally different than what I thought. It wasn't this thing, mutual kind of a thing, but it was David, I think, beginning this process of realizing I'm king and I'm owed, or I deserve. And he saw that and he looked down on her in that. So David then sent servants and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Put a little pin in that Hittite. That's one of David's mighty men. Remember, he's got these soldiers, these guys that fight for him, or fight with him usually, that he sent off to war. So this is somebody he knows. So right there, someplace he shouldn't be doing things, you know, maybe he shouldn't have been doing. And he then gets this information. Oh, well, who is this woman? Finds out she's married. Find out not only is she married, she's married to somebody that he knows. Not that it makes it, well, if he didn't know her, you know, didn't know her husband, then it would be better. Not like that, but I mean, that should be so real to him, what he's about to do and what he starts scheming. They say, you know, this is the wife of you know, one of your soldiers. And it gets uglier from here as David takes the woman that he knows to be the wife of one of his men, and he sleeps with her, and then sends her away. And in that, he's probably thinking, all right, I got away with it. All done. I'm happy. She can be gone now. But then she returns sometime later and tells him that she's pregnant. Part of her, in the ritual washing, it mentions that, is really to signify, you know, it's his. It's not her husband. He's been out at war. And she just went through that ritual, so that means she had had her period, so she's not pregnant by her husband. That means it's David. It's clear. It is very clear that it's his. And at that point, you know, David has to be remembering Jewish law would say, if you remember the story of Jesus and the woman caught in adultery that's brought to him, that, you know, by Jewish law, she would be stoned. Her and the man she was caught with, but of course they just brought her. But she would have been stoned. That's the law. So here your king and this woman, their consequence would be that they would be killed, that they should have been stoned for that. So he's caught. And I imagine he was panicked at that point. Wait, that wasn't supposed to happen. So David starts to panic. His brain races, and he starts to hatch a plan. How can I get away with what I did, and nobody's going to know? Well, less people will know. He is the king in a house, and he sent somebody to go get her, so like people already knew. But anyway, how can I hide this? So David sends word to Joab. This is verse 6. Send me Uriah the Hittite. So Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked about Joab's well-being and that of the people and the condition of the war. You know, he does these things. These would be normal. Like, tell me about, give a report, basically. David says to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. So Uriah left the king's house, and a gift from the king was sent after him. So in this, David's giving permission. You know, hey, thanks. Good job, man. Good report. You guys, good job. Go ahead and go home. And he sent a gift after him. The idea is probably that it was probably food from the king's table, so like good food. The message is, like, hey, go on, go home. You're a soldier. You've been away from your wife for a while. Here's some good food. Wash your feet. You know, clean up. Kind of celebrate. It's kind of a nod and a wink. You know, go home, be with your wife. Have some good food. His idea, you know, like he'll go home, he'll be with his wife. Then they'll assume that the baby's his. David's not fessing up to what he did. Instead, he is trying to have a deception so that what he did, it'll just be like, oh, wow, the baby's, you know, born early. Or what they probably, maybe they didn't have quite the timing, I don't know. But it would have been, nobody would have had any idea what David had done. And in that way, you know, all right, I can get away with it, he's thinking. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. It's verse 10. Now, when they informed David, saying Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, did you not come home from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? And Uriah, he's like, come on, man, you're messing up my plan. Go home. And Uriah the Hittite, says it again, says to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Should I then go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing. Then David says to Uriah, stay here today also, and tomorrow I'll let you go. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the day after. David summoned Uriah, and they ate, and he drank in his presence, and he made Uriah drunk. And in the evening, Uriah went out to lie on his bed with his Lord's servants, and he still did not go down to his house. So the first attempt doesn't work. So David even gets him drunk, thinking, well, once he's drunk, you know, he's going to go home, then nod in a wink, and then I won't have to worry about this anymore. And so he makes it a little bit worse. He keeps trying. And Uriah, even while drunk, doesn't do it, doesn't go home. And it makes it sound like, wow, he's just, you know, he's a really good guy, but he's really committed to David and his forces, and he is. But there's another part of it is, again, the Levitical law gives, there's a law about the men when they are out in the field and they are fighting. And so if he went home and he was with his wife, he would have to go through these cleaning things and all this. And basically, you're not supposed to do that. And if he did, he would have to go through cleaning rituals himself and wouldn't be able to go back and fight. So if you're familiar in literature, sometimes there's characters called a foil. And a foil, it's a character that contrasts another one. In the Bible, the sailors in the story of Jonah, okay, so Jonah's on the boat and there's a storm and the sailors are crying out to their gods, but then Jonah just like stays asleep and ignores it all, and then they find out what's going on, they ask him, they wake him up and they ask him and they find out, so what's going on, and then they cry out. So you have a follower of Yahweh, okay, Jonah, not crying out to God, who he knows why he's doing what he's doing is because of him. And then you have these sailors who don't know Yahweh crying out to him, saying, asking to be saved. You know, there's this contrast. They contrast the way a prophet should act versus the way, you know, the heathens or the non-prophet should act, right? The non-Israelites. So I think it emphasizes that he's a Hittite is because, you know, this is an outsider. This is not somebody that is, you know, an Israelite to the core or anything like that. He's an outsider that has moved in here. And we have an outsider that is obeying the law of God better than the king of the Israelites. And I think that's a contrast of that. So he still doesn't go home. He still doesn't lie with his wife. David's sin is still going to be found out. So David takes a third attempt to cover it up. And this is when, I mean, it's been evil all along, but now it gets really dark. As I said, David is this man that we celebrate him, and we celebrate his passion and his love for God, but he is still human, and he messes up. And it gets dark right here. So in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. He had written in the letter the following: station Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and pull back from him so that he may be struck and killed. So David sets it up for the guy to be murdered. And then not only that, he gives him the note. So, I mean, Uriah is carrying in his hand the note of his own murder, basically. So it was, Joab kept watch on the city that he stationed Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. So he knew there were good fighters here. Okay, we're going to put him here at this spot. And the men of the city went out and fought against Joab. And some of the people among David's servants fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent a messenger and reported to David all the events of the war. Joab has this conversation with the messenger right before he sends him, and he kind of he details what has been going on. But remember, David's not with them, so they are not winning like they should be, and things haven't gone exactly the way they've wanted. And so Joab wants to kind of soften the blow, and he's like, "Okay, so you're going to go, you're going to tell all these things about how we're trying really hard, we're not doing real good." But then he knows that he wants this Hittite guy killed. And so he says, you know, go tell him how things are going really bad, but then end with the Hittite being, you know, Uriah being killed, because that's what he wants. So the messenger departs and came and reported to David everything that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David, "The men prevailed against us and came out against us in the field, but we pressed them as far as the entrance of the gate. Also, the archers shot at your servants from the wall. So some of the king's servants died, and your servant Uriah the Hittite also died." At that point, David, being the guy he is, and he cares about his people, he would be upset. What? You know, these people of ours have died in this battle, and he would either be angry or sad. He should care, right? His people have died in his service. But instead, and I just envision him like doing a little kick of his heels because, all right, my plan succeeded. He says to the messenger, "This is what you should say to Joab. Don't let it bother you. Don't let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Fight with determination against the city and overthrow it, and thereby encourage him." That's gross, because his statement is like, you know, kind of, "Ah, shucks, some people died. Don't worry about it. Not a problem. It happens. It's war." Again, that position of power he has, and he just kind of, because he succeeded in, well, he thinks he has succeeded in covering his sin. Now, when Uriah's wife heard that her husband Uriah was dead, she mourned for her husband. When the time of mourning was over, David sent servants, had her brought to his house, and she became his wife. Then she bore him a son, but the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. So it's like 7 days or something. It's short. And David takes her into his house and marries, basically makes her his wife. And by Jewish law, what David does here looks good. Like, that's the right thing to do when, you know, a husband dies, then you have a single, a widow, there we go. You have a widow, the widow would be married by, you know, a brother, and be restored in that way, and that was how they took care of women when the husband died. They married into somebody else's family. And so David, wow, what a good guy. He, you know, one of his soldiers dies, and he brings the wife of that soldier into his house. That's such a, wow, what a great king we have that he would do that. But the sight of the Lord, right? It tells us he did evil in the sight of the Lord, because even what he did on the outside might look good to the people, God knows a lot better, and he knows what he was trying to do and what he did in that. So then Nathan comes. Nathan was one of the prophets that David had in his household, and It says, the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him, and he said, there were two men in a city, the one wealthy and the other poor. The wealthy man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing at all except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and he nurtured. It grew up together with him and his children. It would eat scraps from him and drink from his cup and lie in his lap, and it was like a daughter to him. Now a visitor came to the wealthy man, and he could not bring himself to take any animal from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the traveler who had come to him. So he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. So you have the wealthy man who has a lot, and instead of taking from what he has, you know, to care for this traveler, he takes what little the poor man has, and he kills it and serves it to the man instead. The abuse of power there, that somebody that is, you know, in this case, he is wealth, but he is over this poor person. It's wrong. And it's wrong that David's anger burned greatly against the man. And he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, this man has done... Sorry. As the Lord lives, the man who has done this certainly deserves to die. So he must make restitution for the lamb four times over since he did this thing and had no compassion. See, David recognizes, and that's one thing, and one of his redeeming qualities, like David's not so far gone that he, so it sounds good to me, like he understands still right and wrong. He sees this and he knows that's not right. It is not right for somebody that is over someone else to take from them. He fully recognizes that and how awful this was. But then Nathan then says to David, you yourself are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. It is I who anointed you as king over Israel, and it is I who rescued you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house and put your master's wives into your care, and I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. God tells them, I've made you who you are. I have given you everything that you need. I've given you more than you need, I think. He goes, and if you needed more than what I've already given to you, I would have given it to you, David. But instead, you chose to do what you did. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You have struck and killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife as your wife, and you have slaughtered him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. So David, all the sins are laid bare as a prophet of God comes and says, this is what you have done. And to David's credit, he knows it. He knows, he gets it. He understands what he's done. And the weight of it is not lost on him. And we know this because he also wrote a psalm that talked about it. Psalm 51, just a part of it. And I'd encourage you, read Psalm 51 today and look at that and think of it in the context of what's going on in David's heart. And it shows, I believe this to be like, he really does realize what he did. He regrets what he did, for sure. It says, be gracious to me, O God, according to your loving kindness. According to the greatness of your compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin, for I know my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. So he gets it. He knows what he did. What's unfortunate, though, is that when you, when there is sin, especially the higher up you are, but what I mean is when the higher your position of leadership, the greater the consequences of your sin. There's consequences of sin no matter who you are or where you're at. The more leadership position you're in, the greater that impact can be. And obviously, as a king, that's going to affect a nation. And David seeks to restore himself. He gets a prophetic curse that tells him, okay, God is forgiving and he loves them and forgives them, but as a leader and as this king, there's consequences. There's going to be some consequences because of what you've done. The natural things that have to happen because of this. At this point, he gets this curse, and he gets told, you're always going to be at war. Like, there's not going to be peace for you. There will always be fighting. He then gets told his kingdom is going to be in upheaval. So the kingdom of Israel is about to, after him, sees terrible infighting, and it splits, and it is because of this curse that he's given. Because of what he did, there is going to be these ripple effects into the entire nation. So the kingdom will be in upheaval. He himself is going to be disgraced. That's one of the things, especially in Middle Eastern cultures, being disgraced, the idea of face and having something done against you, it's much bigger here. Here we just kind of get embarrassed and we move on. But in other countries, it is so much more of a big deal. And so he is going to be disgraced. And then finally it says the child's going to die. The child that came from the relationship that he had, is going to die. And David is seeking to restore himself in that relationship with God. And we see that in that psalm. And I admit, this is one of those things as I was going through this, and I hadn't fully thought about, I know he has the child, and I know the child dies, but I didn't quite realize how a part of the punishment, because it really does sound like the death of the baby was a punishment, part of the punishment to David. And that's hard, because I don't care, an infant death is always hard. You don't want to say there's a silver lining to that. That it's an awful thing, always. And I don't understand that in the scripture here. I feel like it's beyond me that I don't quite get how that works. But I do know, there's some other things, though, that I do know, and I do know that this isn't God's plan. That's not what God wanted. None of this whole situation is what God wanted. Pain, death, disobedience, like David is doing here and the consequences of that, that's not why we were created. That's not why any of us were created. We weren't created for suffering and pain and death. Back in the Garden of Eden, that's not why God made us. He doesn't wish that on us. He doesn't want that for us. That's not part of the plan. And David, what he did and the consequences that followed was not God's plan for him. That's not what God wanted. So in David's sin, though, there's an unwanted pregnancy. There's the murder of a friend, or at least someone he knows. And the consequences is the baby dies. Eventually, this happens later, but he has a daughter that gets raped by one of his sons. He has a son that is murdered by another son. A civil war in the nation of Israel, led by one of his sons, and a son who imitates David's lack of self-control that leads him and much of Israel away from God. It just ripples down into the whole nation. And along this journey that David takes, there were a lot of opportunities for him to choose differently. And I think that's a heavy reminder for us, too, that on our road to sin that we sometimes follow, there's a consequence, but also there are choices along the way that we don't need to, or that we need to be aware of and maybe make different ones. Sin doesn't pop up in front of us and say, ha-ha, I'm the only choice. You must choose me. We like to say, the devil made me do it. You've heard that before. And I'll be honest, that's just not a thing. He doesn't make you do things. you couldn't get away with, you know, the devil tempted me. You know, Jesus was in the wilderness and he was tempted. But just like Jesus in the desert being tempted, he chose not to do it. You know, and if you look at what he was tempted with, all the things that the enemy tempted him with were things that he was supposed to do eventually. They were things that he did have dominion over or would in God's perfect timing. It's not like he was, you know, tempting Jesus to go murder somebody. He wasn't trying to get him to do these things that were like outside of his character. It was all about timing. It's like the timing of what he was trying to get Jesus to do, or to use what his power, you know, that Jesus had because he was God, in a way that wasn't the right way. And so it's an interesting little comparison that you could look at. You know, we choose our sin. And, you know, along this road with David, you know, he could have chosen differently when he got up at night. You know, he got up and went up to the roof. Maybe he didn't go to, maybe he knew that, hey, if I'm up there, I'll see things that I shouldn't see. And then he didn't have to, you know, sounds like he kind of leaned, he saw her, he could have just been like, ooh, and walked away. Instead, he asked people to go find out who she was. He invited her back. Like, he was making these choices all along the way that he could have chosen differently. And how much, like for us, like we get in situations, we can choose differently. We don't have to keep making this, the choices that lead us into the sin that we're headed towards. But then once he committed that first sin, like he could have come up and just confessed and sought to get right. But instead he made choice after choice after choice to cover it. And his choices got worse and worse and worse. Now the story of David, you know, it's not just about David. And this is another one of the things that I hadn't considered when I was younger and when I looked at this story as much. And as I looked at it this time around, I really kept coming back to Bathsheba. And I don't know, I kind of feel like, in my mind at least, she'd been overshadowed by David. You know, David's the hero. David's the story. That's who we're looking at. It doesn't say there was a mutual affair. It doesn't seem like it was adultery. Like she was just, oh, well, my husband's gone. I like this guy. It feels more like David abusing that power that he had as king to take advantage of her. And it starts with, you know, he wasn't where he was supposed to be, you know, leading his troops. That's where he should have been if he was following God. But I think as a king, he was getting a little soft at that point. You know, maybe a little too happy being at home and warm and comfortable. And so he abuses that power to take advantage of her. But what I appreciate in this, and it's a wonderful story, is that she's not forgotten. So even though the story is about David, she is still there. She is still important, and she has a story that's going to get told. With the high schoolers, we've been going through the Old Testament and looking at these big picture story that God's been telling. That God tells about how man sins and God is about restoring us and bringing us to a place of his wounded redeemer, and we are looking for that character. And it's the story of God's chosen people leading to his Savior, and we are following it all along. And it's this big story, right? It's a story of the ages. It's the story of everything. But as we're looking at this big story, there are all these, again, we've got like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, David, right? Big names that we all know. But there's also these supporting characters, right? And they aren't just characters. I use that word, but it's like, you know, they're not, it's not just a story. It's not just characters. This is history, and these are real people. And I believe that about them. So you have these supporting characters, these real people, and they have lives, and they feel. We have like Hagar, the mother of Ishmael, Isaac's half-brother. You know, and she's like a counterpoint to how Isaac wasn't trusting God's promise. You know, she was the maidservant that his wife said, here, have a child with her since I'm not, you know, God's not giving me any. And that wasn't God's plan. God's plan was for him and his wife to have a child. Man steps in and tries to mess things up. And then Hagar gets run off because Abraham's wife doesn't want her there anymore because she has a child and she's upset about it. And so that could be the end, and we could, okay, yeah, Hagar's out of the picture now and we're just looking over here with Abraham and the line to God. But instead, God steps down into the story and he cares for her, and he says, you know, she's crying, she's ready to die in the wilderness with her baby because she's so unhappy with things, and she has, yeah, she's ready to die. And God comes down and he talks to her and he says, I've heard your cries. Don't worry. Go back. I will be with you. And he says, your son is going to have blessings. You know, and he blesses her and her son, even though, and that's Ishmael, even though Ishmael is not the point of the story, that's not God's plan for redeeming his people, he still cares enough about her and this baby to come down and to give them hope and to give them blessing. He does that again. He does that with Leah. That's the unwanted wife of Jacob. He talks to her and he cares for her and he blesses her with children. Tamar, she has to trick Judah into doing the right thing, but she is remembered in the line of Jesus later on. Like, God still knows her and recognizes her and cares for her, even though they are these supporting, you know, it's the supporting cast to the bigger story that God's telling. And these people, they could be plot points. Anybody remember the murder hornets of 2002? Yeah, I don't either. Like, they're gone, right? And that's what these people could be like. They show up, oh, what's that? And then they're gone. But they're not. God remembers them. They matter to him, and he cares about them. And they aren't forgotten. So in the midst of this big story, God reaches down, he steps out of it, and he cares for the individual. Bathsheba is like that. Okay, so she is part of this story, and she kind of gets swept up in David's bad choices and his sin as this king. But God blesses her in different ways. He does give her another son, which again, in the Middle Eastern cultures, especially at that time, so much of their concern and their life was about that line and passing on to that. And it was in their hope, and everything was wrapped up in that child. And so God gave her that. And it's not just any son that he gives her, though. Her son is Solomon, and Solomon becomes king. And when he does, guess where his mom is? She is seated right next to him in 1 Kings, and it's not as a victim. She's not a victim of David's abuse. Instead, she is in the highest place of honor and authority for women in Israel. And that's the queen mother sitting to the side of her son, Solomon, the king. This doesn't excuse what David did or what was done to her. And it's not forgotten. So it's like, you know, it's not like a payoff for what happened to her. But it is a restoring her, giving her, restoring her reputation and giving her blessing, and God watching out and taking care of her. But then what happened to her is not forgotten either. It's still remembered. If you're just like Tamar in the line of Jesus, in Matthew, it says, David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. So it's like saying, remember how David abused his power and took something that wasn't his? Yeah, so do the rest of us. It's right here. You know, it doesn't just say Solomon, the son of Bathsheba, right? That would have been giving respect to Bathsheba, but it's remembering the whole ugly affair, the whole ugly thing that happened, because it says the wife of Uriah. You know, the son of David, but the wife in the wife of Uriah. It is remembered as the act. The what was done is what's being remembered. It's not just the line, but it's how she was, I feel like it's how she was wronged. What David did and how it was bad and how it was wrong. But she is part of that, and she's part of that line to our Savior. And I talked to the high schoolers when we talked about this before with Tamar, and how the line of Jesus has only a few women, and these women, though, that it includes are, their situations weren't good for the most part. They weren't these picture-perfect, princess, pretty, polished situations. There's situations like Bathsheba and Tamar and forgot the name of the spies. Thank you, Rahab. And Rahab. You know, these women that had to make choices they made, you know, and God still remembers them and includes them. And what a neat picture for us that we have this Savior, again, just like David. You know, David didn't look like a king. He didn't come from the right people. He probably didn't speak the right way, exactly. But he falls. Instead, the king that we have, who also doesn't come from the right people and look the right way, but he doesn't fall. See, we get to put our hope and our trust in a king that isn't going to abuse his power, isn't going to take from us. In fact, we have a king that gives us things, gives us good gifts. I hope, I should say the worship team, you're going to want to come up now, but I want you to take away from today, as much as God has this big picture story that is unfolding in front of all creation and the universe that he has made, he's still a God who reaches down, steps out of that bigger story to care for us as individuals. Every hurt, every tear, he knows that. He knows that, and he cares about that. He's not a God that is distant and far away. Our scripture reading this morning, you know, from Luke 12, it tells us, you know, each one of us are important and known by our Heavenly Father. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Yet no one, not one of them, is forgotten by God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are numbered. Don't be afraid, you are worth more than many sparrows. So we have this God, right? And he is big, and he's righteous, and he's just. And he knows us. He knows our hairs on our head. He forgives us. And he still cares about us. He knows our heart. He knows our actions. And he still cares about us. And I hope you take that today.